It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Maria Bartiromo.
I'm Greg Gutfeld.
I'm Tammy Bruce. And this is the Fox News Rundown.
Thursday, November 10th, 2022. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. It may not have been a red wave across the country, but the nation's third most populous state went GOP up and down the ballot. Now the question is, why? Will it last? And do Republicans across the country take note?
What we saw here now is an order of magnitude increase, right, from winning the state by 100,000 in 2016, 400,000 in 2020, to 1.5 million, which I think puts Florida solidly red.
I'm Jared Halpern. It wasn't the wave Republicans wanted, complicating a path for a number of potential GOP leaders.
You don't come at the king unless you're able to defeat the king. So Kevin McCarthy is still in the catbird seat right now.
And I'm Tommy Lahren. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
On Tuesday, election night began with results out of Florida. It wasn't a good night for the GOP there. It was a great night.
Thanks to the overwhelming support of the people of Florida, we not only won election, we have rewritten the political map.
And they literally did. Governor Ron DeSantis pushed through a new map in redistricting, adding 4 Republican-leaning seats, and pulled that out. House Republicans will control 20 seats out of 28 after Florida gained a district. But as Tuesday night unfolded, the numbers out of the different counties started to shake out, and Miami-Dade went red for the first time in years. And people like former Clinton pollster Mark Penn took note, telling our Fox News Radio election night coverage,
"It's unprecedented, really, for a Republican to win Miami-Dade. And the margin that Ron DeSantis has racked up is truly impressive. I don't think there's any question about that. The Democratic Party has collapsed pretty much in Florida."
And as Republicans dominated the state, Senator Marco Rubio sailed to victory in his Senate seat, saying the results were the beginning of something.
"They have joined this incredible new movement that isn't just going to change the country. It's going to change the Republican Party. After tonight, the Republican Party will never be the same. And that's a great thing for America and a great thing for Republicans."
But Miami-Dade's shift toward the GOP meant the Latino vote, at least in Florida, was red. And Republicans hope it not only provides a playbook, but a lasting one at that.
Miami-Dade County's become the story of the country right now.
Francis Suarez is the Republican mayor of Miami.
Because in 2016, Trump lost Miami-Dade County by 30 points to Hillary. In 2020, he lost Miami-Dade County by 8 points to Biden. Now, all Republican candidates that were countywide, that had a countywide election, including Senator Rubio, including Governor DeSantis, won by double digits. So that is a 40% flip-flop from 2016. I mean, that is just massive. And I think what that means is that Hispanics, you know, sort of our message and the message that I've been spreading as the mayor of Miami, which is that we want to keep taxes low, we want to keep people safe, and we want to lean into innovation to create high paying jobs and prosperity. That job is, that message is resonating with Hispanics. It's resonating with the people of Miami-Dade County. They've seen the success. We grew 12%. Our unemployment rate is 1.4%. And we have the lowest tax rate in history, and we're on the precipice of one of the lowest homicide rates per capita in history. Mm-hmm. So that the results with the formula is what I think is compelling.
I was reading that Governor DeSantis lost with Latinos in 2018. This time, Miami-Dade, obviously, as we've just been discussing, went for DeSantis. It's a majority Hispanic county, to my understanding.
It is.
This is the first time a Republican has won this county in a statewide race since 2002, I was reading, since Jeb Bush won. What do you think is happening? What is this about? I know you just talked about some of the issues, but maybe go a little bit deeper. And what's this? Is there a cultural shift happening here? What is this?
Yeah, I would say there's two things at a little bit of a deeper level. One of them is, you know, Democrats' dysfunction when it comes to communicating with Hispanics, right? Trying to brand us as Latinx, right? This sort of monolithic brand that we never wanted, never asked for, and never really liked. I think that was a big miss. Then they went to nuance. They said, okay, well, we missed on the monolithic sort of broad brand. Why don't we go to a nuance brand? And they missed on that when the first lady said that we were as unique as San Antonio tacos, you know? So they missed on that. So I think that was part of it. I think the other part of it is going a level deeper is, you know, many Hispanics in the Miami-Dade County area are traumatized by their origin story insofar as they're escaping communist regimes. So what's happening is, you know, Democrats have failed to disavow socialism, partly because they believe that government can solve every problem. And they just think there's a problem. Let's just grow government. Let's just tax people more and make government the solver of all problems. And we know in Miami intimately that that does not work. It's never worked in the history of humanity, and it's never going to work.
Does this hold moving forward? Like, is this a cultural shift for other Republicans, or is this maybe just about, you know, liking DeSantis or disliking the current Democrats?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily about liking a particular politician because, you know, it was both DeSantis and Rubio that got, you know, significant, so it wasn't like they liked one more than the other. They liked both of them. They liked the message. I think the Republicans have to stay on message, which is the message that I've talked about, anti-socialism, a message of keeping taxes low, keeping people safe, you know, the results. And I think the third thing is we hope that Democrats continue to be dysfunctional on this issue, right? That they don't figure it out, that they don't realize that, you know, Hispanics are nuanced. You know, the issues in Colombia are different from the issues in Ecuador or Uruguay or anywhere else. And to be honest, I think, you know, the former president also deserves credit because, you know, he had a policy to Venezuela and a policy towards Cuba that undid, in the case of Cuba, Obama's detente policy and pro the sort of the regime in a sense of wanting to open up relations and an embassy and all those things. And then I think, you know, when you look at the former president's stance on Venezuela, trying to create a coalition, an international coalition of countries to back Guaido, who was against Maduro, you know, that also engendered that Venezuelan community to the former president. That's why he won Florida by 400,000 votes. What we saw here now is an order of magnitude increase, right? From winning the state by 100,000 in 2016, 400,000 in 2020 to 1.5 million, which I think puts Florida solidly red. Yeah. And of course, you know, that's for the foreseeable future unless and until we hopefully never mess that up.
It remains to be seen, though, how the Latino vote went fully in the rest of the country, right? But the data heading into Tuesday was that while Republicans have made some inroads with different Latino communities, that most of the Latino vote outside of Florida was still leaning with the Democrats. And as you noted, it's not a monolithic voting group. So what's your sort of big picture sense of the Latino community beyond just getting to know all of these different communities? Do you think Republicans have made enough inroads with other Latino groups?
I think that there's still work to be done, right? I think that they've made a lot of inroads. I think that the polling is positive, and I think it's a great opportunity, right? In the sense that if you can tilt all Hispanics in favor of Republicans, you can create generational majorities, right? You go from a situation where you have divisive politics in, let's say, Pennsylvania and Georgia, where a libertarian candidate is disrupting the ability of any one candidate to get over 50%, to 60-40, what we're seeing in Florida, right? But you need to have the right formula, you need to have the right message, and you need to have the right messenger, right? You need to have someone who can connect with those communities. And I think one of the other things that's important about the Hispanic community is that we're fundamentally pro-America. We love this country. We think the fact that we were allowed to come here, the fact that we've been able to create prosperity for ourselves and our family makes this one of the best countries, if not the best country in the world. And that's something that Republicans need to lean into, right? This fundamentally pro-American mindset that Hispanics have. And I think that, you know, the Democrats are obviously on the opposite side, right? We need to be apologizing for everything. You know, we're such a horrible country. We've done so many bad things historically. I mean, which of course is somewhat nonsense, right? Like no country's perfect, but we're a great country. We help a lot of people around the world, and we try to provide for our own.
We saw Florida results early Tuesday night, right? And it was overwhelming for Republicans. But then the night wore on, right? And it became a more mixed evening. And it looks like Democrats may have fended off that red wave that everyone was talking about heading into Tuesday. What is your sense outside of Florida, beyond, of where voters are when you look across the country and you look at some of the results we've seen?
Well, when you look at Florida, what you see as a common theme is young leadership, right? And the question is that going to translate nationally? Is nationally, are we going to see, you know, sort of younger, more aspirational leaders that have a vision? And I think fundamentally, if the campaign is about negatives, you know, running into each other or about being hyper partisan, then again, you're going to see the kind of results that we see in Pennsylvania and Georgia, right? Which is, you know, basically 49-49 and then a libertarian candidate with a couple percentage points, right? And I think that's one formula. The other formula is, hey, how do we create a message that is going to give people hope, that's going to make them feel proud to be Americans, that's going to give them the best possibility, the best chance to realize the American dream, right? That is the fundamental message that I think inspires people, motivates people to vote. And remember, when you talk about a state like Florida and a county like Miami-Dade, there's one big thing in common, and that is 20 to 25% of the state and the county are what they call MPAs, which means no party affiliation, mm-hmm. meaning that they're not Republicans and they're not Democrats. So oftentimes these elections hang in the balance of that 10%, 15%, 20% in any given state that's not affiliated with either party, but wants someone to communicate with them and motivate them. And that clearly broke for Republicans in large numbers. And I think that's important, a key to victory across the country.
Just two more for you. We saw some of the Trump-backed candidates didn't do so well Tuesday night, you know, like Doug Mastriano in Pennsylvania's governor's race, John Gibbs in Michigan's District 3, Don Bolduc lost in New Hampshire. There were some others as well. What would you tell the Republican Party, your colleagues, I guess, in D.C., to maybe take away from that, if anything?
Well, what I would tell them is, you know, we need to support candidates that are strong general election candidates. You cannot, you know, I understand that you got to win a primary, and I understand that the primary process is a purity test in a way. Mm-hmm. But I think what's important is, do we have someone that's principled, that believes in the core of what we believe in, but can also broaden the base and broaden his or her support so that Republicans can remain in power and so that our country doesn't go in the direction that Democrats want to take it. Right. And so I think that is the question. And, you know, I've often said in many interviews that a presidential election is a litmus test on where the country is in any given moment. And, you know, this election, which is a midterm, gives us a tremendous insight into where the country's heading. And the question is, where will the country be in the next 2 years?
Mm-hmm. Finally, former President Trump, as you know, is set to make an announcement next week. And I know you heard him call Governor DeSantis Ron DeSanctimonious. Does DeSantis run? Should he? Does Trump run? Should he?
Look, I think we'll find out on Tuesday what he decides one way or the other, and we'll see what the governor does. I think there's a lot at stake in 2024. It's an important election for this country. We're at a crossroads. We have, you know, challenges all over the world, from the rise of China to conventional war in Ukraine to energy crisis in Europe. South America's trending socialist. Supply chain issues, energy issues in the U.S. Obviously, hyperinflation and rising interest rates. I mean, these are massive challenges, and I think the American people should expect the very best candidates to apply for the job, if you will, right? And make the best case for leading them, right? 330 million people. But I think all those dominoes are going to fall into place, in the next couple of weeks and months.
Miami Mayor Francis Suarez, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
This is Tommy Lahren with your Fox News commentary coming up.
Kevin McCarthy is running after House Republicans appear poised to win control of the House, albeit by a far slimmer margin than the red wave projected. McCarthy has written the fellow Republicans asking for their support to become the next Speaker of the House. McCarthy has been the House minority leader, the top Republican in the chamber, since 2019. In his campaign pitch, McCarthy says he intends to reopen the Capitol and end proxy voting, devote resources to go toe-to-toe with the executive branch, promising oversight and holding the Biden administration accountable. But reaching the top post is not a given if the House majority is slim.
They can pass a lot of messaging bills in the House of Representatives, but that will be even harder because you will have the extreme polls in that conference, especially on the right, the Freedom Caucus, asking them to do things on abortion and investigations into Hunter Biden's laptop and all sorts of things. And many Republicans will go along with that.
Chad Pergram is congressional correspondent for Fox News.
But some of these more extreme elements are things that a lot of Republicans just won't want to have any part of, especially considering what the result is. I mean, I talked to several Republicans. One said that, you know, the former President Trump was killing the Republican Party with independents. That's a real problem. Now, we saw success by the Republicans in a few areas. You had these districts that were drawn in Florida in favor of Trump-centric districts. And so guess who performed well there? Republicans. They flipped to what has generally been Miami-Dade County. Some of the Cuban-American community, you know, some of the Latinos in Florida, they do not see the Democratic Party the same way that it was generally believed that they saw the Democratic Party some years ago. However, you had Democratic successes along, of all places, a place that Republicans have spent inordinate amounts of time along border districts. Henry Cuellar in Texas and Vicente Gonzalez in Texas. All of those places, these held on, you know, on the Democratic side of the aisle. But Democrats also enjoyed a lot of success. And, you know, it is sometimes said that revenge is a dish best served cold. And that was certainly the case. The one scalp that the Republicans got was of Sean Patrick Maloney. Democrat represents the Hudson River Valley in upstate New York, north of New York City. He was in charge of the Democrats' reelection efforts to the House of Representatives, and he lost his seat.
Yeah.
And Republicans also picked up a couple of other seats in New York. Now, you would think that New York would be a place that favored the Democrats. And what happened is there was a lot of litigation, and finally a special master. We've heard a lot about special masters in Florida with former President Trump after the Mar-a-Lago raid, but was impaneled to put together a district or a set of districts in upstate New York because they felt that Democrats had, you know, curved things in their favor too much. And so even though Kathy Hochul, the Democratic governor of New York, who was believed to be in trouble just a few days ago and won, you know, pretty overwhelmingly, much to the surprise of a lot of Republicans, Democrats did not do as well in upstate New York in some of these House races, starting with knocking off Sean Patrick Maloney.
So, but Democrats did do well in some of the areas that Republicans had heavily invested. You look at some of those races in the Northeast, you look at certainly Virginia, right? So this wave that was expected does not appear to be materializing. There is going to be an awful lot of finger pointing amongst Republicans. Where are those fingers going to point?
Well, it's kind of like you have individual, you know, you don't talk about a general national wave, but you talk about individual waves on tributaries that run through different parts of the country. That's why the Republicans won. Now, you talk about the finger pointing. We wonder how much finger pointing there will be at Kevin McCarthy, who is poised to be the Speaker of the House, but they might only have 221, 222 seats. I should note that in the 72nd Congress in 1931, the Republicans had the majority with 218 seats, which is the bare minimum of what you need. They've had some other smaller majorities as well. The Democrats right now are in the low 220s, so that's significant. So it really wasn't much of a change there. And what happened was this, is you had Republicans in 2020. They won every jump ball race in the House of Representatives, which is why they almost, much to the surprise of everyone, almost won control of the House in 2020. This time around, they did not run the table. It would be hard to do that anyway 2 years in a row. And so even though they picked up these seats in upstate New York and in Florida, they were losing seats in other places. They, you know, they lost the seat in Alaska. That's a seat that they've lost there. They were not able to flip all three of the Virginia seats. There was a seat in Indiana, northwestern Indiana. They didn't knock off Marcy Kaptur in northern Ohio. Greg Landsman, a Democrat, defeated Steve Shabbat in southern Ohio, Cincinnati. So that's the difference there, is that, you know, is that Democrats were able to win some of those seats. And so how much emphasis do they put on Kevin McCarthy?
Yeah.
Or the person who probably takes the fall here is the person on the Republican side who is in charge of their reelection efforts, Tom Emmer, the congressman from Minnesota. And guess what? Tom Emmer, if Republicans are in fact in the majority, he is running for the number three position to be the whip. One would be hard pressed to think that he would probably win that race right now when he's up against Jim Banks of Indiana and also Drew Ferguson of Georgia.
There has been reporting that Steve Scalise, who would be poised to be the number two House Republican, is the majority leader, is not going to mount a challenge to Kevin McCarthy for Speaker. If that is factual, if that is the thinking of Steve Scalise, is there anybody who could put a challenge to Kevin McCarthy for the speakership?
Anybody that former President Donald Trump gets behind. And the first person I would look at, if it were to come to pass, and I was told that things are very eerily quiet among Republicans right now, because I think they're trying to figure out where this is all going right now.
I think they want to make sure they have the majority first.
Well, exactly. As somebody said to me, there was one Republican I spoke with, you know, who really gets this, who said, I guess we get to 218 is kind of what they said. Okay, I guess so. So who knows? I mean, it could take a couple of weeks to sort this out. So nothing happens until that point. But you're absolutely right. You don't come at the king unless you're able to defeat the king. So Kevin McCarthy is still in the catbird seat right now. But there is a reason why he did not become the Speaker of the House in 2015 when John Boehner went away. And you had Republicans in that instance who weren't completely sold on Kevin McCarthy and were looking for a reason to vote against him. What was that reason then? I mean, because they didn't like him to start with. Some didn't or thought he was up to the job. And so he went on our air on Fox and said that the Republicans only put together the Benghazi committee just so they could stick it to Hillary Clinton and undercut her presidential bid. And so he kind of said the quiet part out loud. And so the Republicans said, oh, no, we're going to vote for that. Or it's just not enough. It was just enough who might not vote for him. So I would look very closely if this does come to fruition, you know, some sort of challenge here. The first person I would look at is Jim Jordan.
Now, he's poised to become chairman of the Judiciary Committee.
Yes, and he's the founder of the Freedom Caucus.
Yeah.
And the Freedom Caucus is going to have more power in a smaller majority. Yeah. Not only that, he's pretty much endorsed, you know, through and through by former President Trump.
Well,
and it wasn't that long ago that he was a rival to Kevin McCarthy. He ran against Kevin McCarthy for minority leader in 2018 and lost. And Kevin McCarthy realized he was vulnerable on that flank, brought him into the fold. And I don't know, we're just a few hours into this here.
But, you know, to that point, there was reporting Tuesday night, is polls are still open in some places, or at least closing in some places as the counts are coming in, that there are a growing number of Republicans who say it's time to move away from the former president after what happened.
Well, the thing that was a problem for them is that, you know, he just did not perform well with independent voters, and that you know, knocked a lot of these independent voters away from Republicans.
So does that make it less likely then that somebody like Jim Jordan can mount a challenge?
Well, but again, in that wing of the conference, yes.
Yeah.
Because this is where you're going to have to get into the mechanics of what it takes to elect the speaker. You have to have an outright majority of the entire House. So in other words, when you win in your conference, which is smaller than the entire House. So let's say hypothetically they get 222 seats. So if you get 212, you're the Republican conference's nominee for speaker. But the entire House, right, votes for speaker, and you have to have an outright majority of the entire House, 435, so you need 218. So this was the problem McCarthy was running into 7 years ago. Maybe this is that fight delayed by 7 years ago, and it comes to fruition now. Now, here's the other problem. You know, what do Republicans do? Do they forget the, you know, lessons of Tuesday night immediately when former President Trump supposedly announces next week?
Yeah.
And how do Republicans finesse this? Or does that stir them up, you know, with their base in their districts, these red, you know, red districts that, you know, they're 30-40% of the country because they're just full in for Trump. But that's it. And you're going to have just enough other moderate Republicans or others who come in and say, I can't be for that. And the only thing that gets Republican voters to the polls is former President Trump. So if he's not on the ballot, you see, this is a little bit of what happened here in 2018. One of the reasons why Democrats gained control of the House was because Trump was not on the ballot.
But
guess who wasn't on the ballot this time? former President Trump. Guess who, you know, and they can't even knock off, you know, the Democrats here, you know, with a knockout blow, despite the unpopularity, serious unpopularity of President Biden. That's amazing in a sense. You know,
but one of the controversial strategies that emerged here out of the Democratic playbook was they invested in Republican primaries to try and get the more MAGA friendly Republicans nominated in the first place. And they, you know, they were criticized heavily for that, right? Most of those candidates ended up losing in the general. Does that tell us anything about that strategy? I mean, it seems
well, it
like
worked.
Maybe
that's the first thing it tells us. Yeah.
But I mean, what does that then tell us about 2024?
I talked to one Democrat who said they were glad that it worked, but they didn't support it. They thought it was a little immoral. And
it was also pretty risky, right?
Well, yes, yes. And again, maybe, you know, maybe this is what you do. You know, they certainly did this way in Western Michigan, defeating Peter Meyer, Republican congressman there, somebody who had, you know, opposed the president, the former president, on a lot of issues, you know, certainly after the riot and voted against the president in that regard. And then he lost. So, yes, that is something the Democrats are going to have to wrestle with. And it's hard to catch lightning in the bottle twice. So even if it worked this time, you know, it would be hard pressed, not even 24 hours out, to say, well, in the fall of 2024, we should do that again.
Sure.
We don't know what the atmosphere is going to be like. There's some people now saying maybe former President Trump should withhold on his announcement. Maybe he should really, you know, I mean, you might have people going to him on bended knee saying, please, please, please don't run again. Look how well we did in Florida with Ron DeSantis and these districts that were drawn by Governor DeSantis down there. And we can win with that.
Well,
I mean, that is reality for the Republican Party. And that's something they're going to have to wrestle with. And again, this comes back is that this is a gigantic Tylenol worthy headache for Kevin McCarthy.
Well, you and I have talked about how this is going to be an interesting lame duck session here to close out this year. It just got way more interesting, so we will continue to have these conversations in the weeks ahead. Chad Pergram, always appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Meet the American who
first commanded the U.S. Marines.
Samuel Nicholas, the first commandant of the Marines, was born to a Philadelphia Quaker family in 1744. Orphaned as a young boy at the age of seven, he was adopted by a politically prominent uncle, Atwood Chute, who served as mayor of Philadelphia. Nicholas was commissioned first captain of the Marines by the Second Continental Congress in November of 1775 and immediately raised a battalion of 300 Marines. He then led the first assault in the Marines' history, the raid on Nassau, the Bahamas, on March 3rd, 1775. Capturing British gunpowder and munitions. The successful amphibious raid set a key precedent. The Marines attacked from the sea to land in many World War II battles, such as Iwo Jima. Nicholas, for his bravery, leadership, and daring, was eventually promoted to major. Peter Miller, the curator of the National Museum of the Marine Corps in Virginia, told Fox News Digital, Samuel Nicholas is an American hero. Nicholas died in Philadelphia during the yellow fever epidemic of 1790. Every November 10th, during the Marine Corps' birthday celebrations, U.S. Marines worldwide celebrate Major Nicholas. I'm Gianna Gelosi. Go to the lifestyle section of foxnews.com for more of these incredible American stories.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Tommy Lahren.
What's on your mind?
Tuesday was a historic day, and I'm proud to say I participated. I waited in line in person on Election Day at my designated location, and then, get this, I showed my ID. What a novel concept! As it stands, 35 states have laws requesting or requiring voters to show some form of ID at the polls, and I'm not sure what the heck the other 15 are thinking, but it's about time they get with the program. The most effective yet simplest election integrity mechanism we have should be the law of the land in every land. It's not oppressive, it's not racist, and it's not that hard. If you have to show an ID to get into a bar or board an airplane, you should have to show one to vote for the leaders of our nation. Heck, despite being lambasted for their election integrity law, Georgia had record voter turnout. Also, the pandemic is over, so why are some states states still married to mass mail-in voting. It's not only time we get our country back, but restore election integrity in every nook and cranny. I'm Tommy Lahren.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.